Welcome back to EVR 2858, Lecture 9, the Clean Air Act, Part 2. By the end of this lecture, you should be able to describe the four emissions regulated by Title 2 of the Clean Air Act relating to motorized vehicles, how long a waiver is good for, and to how much of an auto manufacturer's production does it apply to, what city is the Title 2 pollution numbers based on, and what is a clean fuel vehicle. Now, last class, we talked about state implementation plans. Well, what about Florida's SIP? The Florida Department of Environmental Protection has a Division of Air Resource Management. This division established and runs the Florida Spatial Air Quality System and displays the air quality index for all ambient air quality monitors in the state. The Air Quality Today webpage shows a map with dots denoting the various air stations across the state. If you click on a dot, it will bring up the county where that station is located. If you click on an individual dot again, it will bring up information on the specific air station. For more specific information on the Florida-specific SIPs, here are the official SIPs according to the EPA. Overall, Florida air quality is pretty good. I guess that's because we're flat and, well, we're surrounded by ocean. All right, so Title II. Standards for automobile exhaust emissions. In the Clean Air Act, Congress dictated direct, highly specific statutory standards to clean the air, implementing a statutory tactic to force technology improvements. This is not finesse, but basically using a sledgehammer to tap in a one-inch nail. Now, a little bit of history. Before the Clean Air Act amendments were passed in 1970, auto emissions were responsible for approximately 60% of all air pollutants by weight and 30 to 60% of the three main pollutants, hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, and nitrogen oxides. Congress did nothing to control auto emissions, only stressing research into auto technology. The state of California decided to move ahead and imposed its own strict emission standards. Overall, California maintains the strictest state standards in the country to this day. In 1967, Congress passed the Air Quality Act, which had few substantive restrictions but preempted state regulations of auto emissions, except for California. Congress again tried to encourage the automakers to reduce emissions voluntarily, but it became clear that the auto manufacturers were dragging their feet. It should be noted that before the 1970 amendments were passed, there was debate in Congress on a proposal to ban all internal combustion engines by 1985. While the proposal failed, the fact that it was debated at all demonstrates the extreme options Congress was willing to consider as remedies for the problem of air pollution. So, in the 1970 Clean Air Act amendments, Congress enacted Title II to force the development of new technologies. So we have 42 U.S.C. Section 7521 emission standards for new motor vehicles or new motor vehicle engines. This section gives permission to the EPA administrator to prescribe and revise emission standards for new motor vehicles or new motor vehicle engines. It says Congress sets out in subsection A3A that the EPA administrator shall, doesn't have any choice here, create regulations regarding the emissions of hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, oxides of nitrogen, and particulate matter from motor vehicles or engines from the 1983 model year and on. These regulations shall reflect the greatest degree of emission reduction achievable through the application of technology that the administrator determines will be available for that model year, giving appropriate consideration to cost, energy, and safety factors associated with the application of such technology. Now note, we saw similar technology-based regulations concept in the Clean Water Act, but we will see some notable differences in the content of this regulation coming up. So they had to establish classes of vehicles. This is based on gross vehicle weight, horsepower, type of fuel used, or other appropriate factors. So there are light-duty trucks up to 6,000 pounds gross vehicle weight and light-duty vehicles. There are heavy-duty trucks, bus, or other vehicle for use on public roads, which has a gross vehicle weight in excess of 6,000 pounds. and there are motorcycles, they are treated as heavy-duty vehicles unless the administrator reclassifies them by rule. Please note, this is my grandmother on my father's 1987 Harley-Davidson Sportster 1100 back in 1998. Please note that the Harley is standing still. My grandmother would not be on it if it was moving. Parsing the language. So let's take a look at this. The EPA administrator is supposed to publish regulations that cover hydrocarbons, carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides, and particulate matter from cars and trucks. The standard is the greatest degree of emission reductions achievable through the application of technology. The administrator is to consider cost, energy, and safety factors. This is important. Remember, with the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, the administrator was strictly required not to consider costs. Here, the administrator is told to consider costs as well as the energy it takes to make the technology and run the technology, as well as any possible safety problems that may crop up with running the technology. Lead time and stability. Section 7521A3C says any standard promulgated or revised under this paragraph and applicable to classes or categories of heavy-duty vehicles or engines shall apply for a period of no less than 3 model years, beginning no earlier than the model year commencing 4 years after such revised standard is promulgated. Uh-huh. What does this say in English? Deciphering this section, it says that manufacturers have only 4 years to come up with the necessary technology once a standard is promulgated, and that there may be only 3 years where the technology is useful. So, year 1, a standard is promulgated. By year 5, the manufacturers must have technology in place for their automobiles to abide by that standard. In year 6, the government tightens the standard. Now, the manufacturers can keep the current technology through year 7, but to have to have new technology in place for year 10. It's pretty tough. Section 7521B, emissions of carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons, and oxides of nitrogen. So here they set out the standards. The standard started low, 1.5 grams per vehicle mile of hydrocarbons, 15 grams per vehicle mile of carbon monoxide for the 77 to 79 models. They ramped up the restrictions in 1980, limited carbon monoxide to 7 grams per vehicle mile. So they basically cut it in half. By 1981 model year, reduction of 90% of hydrocarbons and carbon monoxide from 1970 model year levels. With emissions of oxides of nitrogen, again, the standard started low, model years 77 to 80, limited emissions to 2 grams per vehicle mile of oxides of nitrogen, and they ramped up restrictions in 81 to no more than 1 gram per mile. In subsequent 1C, Congress specifically states that the EPA administrator shall not modify any of the numerical emission standards set out by Congress in this section after November 15, 1990. If you want to see the actions EPA has taken regarding mobile sources, then go to Title 40 of the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 86, Emission Standards. So, in Section A, Congress gave the administrator the authority to establish regulations applicable to motor vehicles. But Congress then sets out the maximum amounts of emissions of carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons, and nitrogen oxides. These limits took away all possible foot dragging, legal maneuvering, and possible court actions manufacturers could bring against the administrator in order to delay the imposition of the standards. Nice trick, wouldn't you say? So Section 7521C, Feasibility Study and Investigation by the National Academy of Sciences. The administrator shall, again, no choice, undertake to enter into appropriate arrangements with the National Academy of Sciences to conduct a comprehensive study and investigation of the technological feasibility of meeting the emission standards required to be prescribed by the administrator by Section B of this section. So we have a feasibility study. Again, we have Congress here trying to get politics out of science by advising the EPA administrator to use the expertise of the National Academy of Sciences in studying technological feasibility of emission standards. Remember, with the Everglades, Congress relies on the National Academy of Sciences to do the science instead of everything being solely political. So we have waivers, and it The EPA is the one who has the authority to grant these. If the manufacturer demonstrates that a waiver is necessary to permit the use of an innovative powertrain technology or innovative emission control device system, it requires the waiver not endanger public health, the substantial likelihood that the vehicles or engines will be able to comply with the applicable standard under this section at the expiration of the waiver, and there is potential for long-term air quality benefit and the potential to meet or exceed the average fuel economy standard applicable upon the expiration of the waiver. Note we've got fuel economy here. No waiver applies to more than 5% of such manufacturer's production or more than 50,000 vehicles or engines, whichever is greater. And note, the waiver is only good for 1 year. So, the standard is set in year one. The manufacturer has to have the standard in place by year five, but there are problems with the technology. So the manufacturer applies for a waiver in order to tweak the technology. Okay, but take a look at this. The waiver only applies to 5% of all the manufacturer's vehicles or 50,000 vehicles total, whichever is greater. There are limits to how much the waiver applies to. Let's go back to subsection A1, which requires the administrator to come up with the regulations. The second sentence stated that such standards shall be applicable to such vehicles and engines for their useful life. So what's the useful life of a vehicle? Section 7521D gives us our definition. The EPA administrator shall create regulations to determine the useful life of vehicles and engines. The term useful life shall be for light duty vehicles, vehicle engines and trucks, so 3750 pounds up to 6,000 pounds, 5 year or 50,000 miles, whichever occurs first, before November 19th, 1990, after November 15th, 1990, where the useful life period is not otherwise specified for such vehicles and engines, the period shall be 10 years or 100,000 miles or the equivalent, whichever occurs first. In the case of any other motor vehicle or engine, not including motorcycles, subsection D1 above shall be applied unless the administrator determines a period of greater duration or mileage is appropriate. For cars made before the 1992 model year, the useful life of a car is 5 years or 50,000 miles. After the 1992 model year, it is 10 years or 100,000 miles. But something to keep in mind. The law states that for in-compliance testing, only 7 years, or 75,000 miles is the standard. This requires manufacturers to make a better car that pollutes less and lasts longer. Let's think about this. Is this enough? Look at what is on the roads today. How many small cars do you regularly see on the road? I see lots of pickup trucks that have lower emission standards. And all the SUVs that are judged under the lower pickup truck standards. And then there are still all those Hummers out there. The Clash for Clunkers program was aimed at getting poor performing cars off the road, but without having to go through all this CAA stuff. On top of that, how many 1970s and 1980s car models are still out on the road right now? And what about all those 50s and 60s classic cars? We require new cars to have fewer emissions, but what about all the old cars still out there polluting? Should we do something about those vehicles? If you like the movie The American President, the theme was to curb greenhouse gases by decreasing auto emissions. Katie, 10 years from now, any car with an internal combustion engine is going to be considered a collector's item. Come on board, we'll make your Volvo a classic. Cindy Ellen Wade, The American President. So now we have new power sources or propulsion systems. In the event of a new power source or propulsion system for new motor vehicles or new motor vehicle engines is submitted for certification pursuant to Section 7525A of this title, the administrator may postpone certification until he has prescribed standards for any air pollutants emitted by such vehicle or engine, which in his judgment cause or contribute to air pollution, which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger the public health or welfare, but for which standards have not been prescribed under subsection A of this section. So we know that Congress batted around the idea of totally banning the internal combustion engine. What if some entrepreneur decides to do just that? What about the Back to the Future car? At the end of the movie, where Doc Brown comes back from the future to visit Marty, and before they go to the future because Marty's kids are idiots, Doc Brown takes some banana peels, dead beer, and other organics and puts it in this disposal unit on the car for fuel. Pretty neat idea, right? And of course, here's my need for fun trivia. The Mr. Fusion home energy reactor that is seen on the back of the DeLorean at the end of the first Back to the Future film was a joke on Mr. Coffee. This is a miniature replica in this picture. The one in the actual movie was based on a coffee grinder made by Krupps. Well, what about the French fry car? The car that runs on recycled cooking oils. Section E requires the administrator to take a close look at any new engine for new types of pollutants. The new engine doesn't produce carbon monoxide, hydrocarbons, or nitrogen oxides. Yeah, let's go with it. Save the air. Actually, if you have a car that runs on diesel fuel, you can convert it into a grease car. And there you go. You've got the link to convert your car. For chick flick fans, there is a joke about grease cars in the movie The Jane Austen Book Club. So, Title II standards. Title II's standards were not only quantitatively specific, but were also very tough. A 90% rollback in emissions in a 5-year horizon was a drastic order. The congressionally dictated standards were patently defined to be technology forcing. Congress commanded that the automakers come up with new technology or stop selling cars, unless they could win a 1-year waiver from the EPA under Section 7521C4. So where do these numbers come from? This technology forcing was pretty unfair to the automakers. A major thing to note about the 90% rollback numbers is that they were based on the smog conditions in Los Angeles and a few other cities, like New York. Even though the numbers were based on a very small geographic area, all cars in America had to meet those standards. And even within Los Angeles, the requirements were probably not strict enough. Therefore, weren't these 90% numbers unnecessary? Is this a good thing to have a small part of the country drive regulations across the entire country? Some say no, include some automakers. Some say yes, including automakers. For years, American Honda has bragged that their cars sold in Florida meet California's strict air quality standards. So, technology forcing. It is important to note that the waiver provision does not alleviate the very tight deadlines for statutory compliance. 5 years was a very short time to design new technology, test it out, and get it into the production line. The strict technology forcing schedule practically boxed the industry into a strategy of tinkering with the old-style engines rather than innovating with cleaner-burning engine designs. The reason why Congress turned to such draconian technology forcing measures was because the automobile industry dragged its feet on any types of pollution control technology. Let's take a look at some background on this to get a better perspective. So, another bit of history. This information is quoted directly from a 1968 Department of Justice memorandum. In early 1951, Dr. Artie J. Hagensmith at the California Institute of Technology discovered that when oxides of nitrogen, ozone, and gasoline vapors, i.e. hydrocarbons, were introduced into a plexiglass test chamber and exposed to ultraviolet light, i.e. sunlight, an irritating haze with all the properties of natural smog was formed. Following the publication and general acceptance of the Hagensmith theory, the automobile industry finally acknowledges that motor vehicles contributed to air pollution, which it had steadfastly denied before. The problem of how to control motor vehicle emissions was then turned over by the industry to the Automobile Manufacturers Association, a trade association whose members manufacture 99% of the cars, trucks, and buses produced annually in the United States. From the very outset, the industry realized that air pollution control devices do not help sell automobiles. The AMA board formed the Vehicle Combustion Products Committee to direct all industry efforts on a non-competitive basis. An AMA internal memorandum prepared for presentation at VCP and Engineering and Advisory Committee meetings disclosed that dilatory tactics prevailed. On the basis of the facts, the industry is not convinced that exhaust emissions devices or systems are necessary for nationwide application to motor vehicles, but believes instead that they will be an economic and maintenance burden on motorists. It is therefore not prepared or desirous to initiate any voluntary program to impose these systems or devices. The Justice investigation revealed the existence of an AMA cross-licensing agreement designed to eliminate competitive incentives to develop emissions technology. The AMA cross-licensing agreement placed the automobile producers in a position where they did not have to fear that a competitor would develop an effective device or system for its exclusive use, which might become required equipment and thus put the others at a competitive disadvantage. Further, Justice found that the automakers had agreed not to purchase or utilize any device developed by a non-signatory to the cross-licensing agreement. This investigation led to the filing of a major antitrust suit against GM, Ford, Chrysler, and AMC in 1968 in the final weeks of the Johnson administration. The industry's strategy played out revealingly in the state of California's smog control initiatives. California, impatient with the federal inaction, had passed its auto emissions law in 1960, setting tough emissions limits despite industry protests that the limits were technologically impossible to meet. It provided that when any two control devices were developed and certified by the State Motor Vehicles Pollution Control Board as effective emissions controls, all new cars in California would have to install emissions controls within 1 year. The Motor Vehicle Control Board approved four devices developed by independent manufacturers in 1964, which made the installation of pollution control equipment mandatory on 1966 models. Instead of utilizing any of the approved devices, the auto companies utilized devices or systems which they themselves developed. It turned out that the combustion control and catalytic systems installed in the AMA members' California cars in 1966 under their cross-licensing agreement had long been known or even patented by the automakers, in some cases since the 1930s. Given its history, Congress was in no mood to yield to the automakers' gripes about unaccomplishable technology forcing. So what about that antitrust suit? That was settled shortly after President Nixon took office, but the case did significantly diminish the strength of the automakers' lobby on Congress and allowed for Title II to be passed. When Title II was enacted, the automobile industry decried it as overkill. No matter what the industry said, Title II did force change and did improve air quality. Between 1970 and 1987, hydrocarbons and carbon monoxide emissions from new cars dropped by 96%, and oxides of nitrogen by 76%. Alterations in auto technology brought about other beneficial changes as well. Use of the catalytic converter, for example, required that fuel companies develop unleaded gasoline, since leaded fuel poisons the converter and makes it ineffective as a pollution control device. As a result, lead emissions fell 94% between 1976 and 1986, and correspondingly, lead levels in Americans' blood dropped by one-third. Was all this worth the cost? Air quality on highways and in congested urban areas has improved since the 1970 amendments, but the goal of eliminating all auto-caused pollution is still far away. Despite the strict statutory standards, increased traffic volume and lax enforcement have undermined improvements. Since the 70 amendments, new air pollution has come to our attention, including high levels of ground-level ozone, low levels of stratospheric ozone, acid deposition, and the greenhouse effect. So we have political wrangling. It should also be noted that EPA enforcement and congressional backing has been occasional, and this is due to politics. The industry has lobbied hard about the dire economic straits that enforcement has caused, especially with the influx of foreign-made automobiles. Take a look at this. In 1974, during the first Arab oil embargo, Congress approved new amendments to the CAA, which delayed until 1976 the effective date of all tailpipe standards and allowed the EPA administrator to delay these standards an additional year. Selective enforcement auditing. The EPA administers a program called selective enforcement auditing. Under SEA, cars are tested for emissions at the end of the assembly line, and calculations are made to extrapolate emissions levels as they will be at the end of the automobile's useful life. The EPA has developed a regulatory loophole. Regulations require that no more than 40% of the tested automobiles fail to meet the standards. EPA considers this 40% failure rate to be an acceptable quality level. Autos meeting this generous standard are awarded an EPA certificate of conformance. Given this leeway, it is not surprising that auto emissions are still causing notable air pollution problems. EPA testing. Even if the EPA required a higher passing rate, an actual tailpipe emissions from the average gasoline-powered car were cut by 60%. The ever-increasing number of drivers and total mileage driven in America and around the world would quickly nullify the gains. So, what strategies will guide future efforts to alleviate auto-caused air pollution? A fundamental problem is that although Americans have grown increasingly concerned about environmental problems, we, and this probably includes most environmentalists, are unwilling to sacrifice our automobility. We had a large drop in pleasure drives back in June 2008 when crude oil was over $160 a barrel. We had a large drop in car usage in March 2020 when the U.S. shut down due to COVID-19. And global air quality got better over the remainder of 2020 due to less car usage. But now we are back to mostly normal driving patterns. But with the current war in the Ukraine and banning use of Russian oil, prices have been fluctuating. When I did this update, oil prices were $68.26 per barrel on March 15, 2023. Additionally, we are competing more with China to get a share of the current supply. So, clean fuels. Environmentalists and industry people alike have begun looking beyond the gasoline-fired internal combustion engine for solutions to the air pollution crisis we are now facing. Does Congress even consider this? Why, yes, they do! Under Subtitle 2, Part C deals with what they term as clean fuel vehicles. So 42 U.S.C. Section 7581, Subsection 7, Clean Fuel Vehicle. The term clean fuel vehicle means a vehicle in a class or category of vehicles which has been certified to meet for any model year the clean fuel vehicle standards applicable under this part for that model year to clean fuel vehicles in that class or category. Telluride power and intergalactic hydrogen. On September 15, 2004, a team from Intergalactic Hydrogen and Telluride Power drove a hydrogen-fueled vehicle to 13,114 feet above sea level while crossing Imogene Pass between Telluride and Silverton, Colorado. This rugged, Rocky Mountain jeeping road put Ty Robinson's conversion to the ultimate test in grade, ambient air pressure, and duration through several long scrambles past the Tomboy Mining ghost town. The drive was so successful, the team continued on to the Red Mountain Pass overlook at approximately 13,150 feet above sea level, taken from the Telluride power site, which is no longer up and running. All right, so clean alternative fuel. The term clean alternative fuel means any fuel, including methanol, ethanol, or other alcohols, including any mixture thereof, containing 85% or more by volume of such alcohol with gasoline or other fuels, reformulated gasoline, diesel, natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, and hydrogen, or power source, including electricity, used in a clean fuel vehicle that complies with the standards and requirements applicable to such vehicle under this subchapter when using such fuel or power source. In the case of any flexible fuel vehicle or dual fuel vehicle, the term clean alternative fuel means only a fuel with respect to which such vehicle was certified as a clean fuel vehicle, meeting these standards applicable to clean fuel vehicles under Section 7583D2 of this title when operating on clean alternative fuel or any CARB standards, which replaces such standards pursuant to Section 7583E of this title. Yeah, if you understood that on the first read, I'm impressed. It took me a few. Hybrid vehicles. Take a look at the Honda car company with their hybrid engine, for instance. For 2019, the hybrid models were the Accord Hybrid, the Clarity Hybrid, and the Insight Hybrid. The Honda Clarity is a plug-in electric vehicle with a backup gas tank. Back in 2010, Honda only had the Honda Civic Hybrid as their only flex fuel vehicle. Let's look at the 2019 Clarity Hybrid. It has an inline four-cylinder engine with 103 horsepower at 5,500 RPM. Honda advertised this car has a 7-gallon fuel tank and gets 44 miles per gallon city, 40 highway, and 42 miles per gallon combined. Honda advertised that the Clarity can go 47 miles on one electric charge, and it gets a total of 340 miles electric and gas combined. The base price for the Clarity was $33,400 MSRP. If you want all the bells and whistles with the Touring Edition, that will cost $36,600 MSRP. A little high for a car, right? If you got a regular Honda Civic sedan, the low-end model starts at $19,450 MSRP. If you want all the bells and whistles for Honda Civic Sedan Touring Edition, that will set you back $27,300 MSRP in 2019. Now, all electric possibilities. Since around 2010, car manufacturers have been selling electric vehicles. One of the first widely available electric vehicles came from Nissan with their Leaf. LEAF was an acronym meaning Leading Environmentally Friendly Affordable Family Car. Now, in 2023, the Nissan LEAF is still around and starts around $30,750. In fall 2022, Car and Driver listed 34 different currently available electric vehicles and a list of what's to come in the market. Awesome, you say! There are lots of electric cars to choose from. The main problem with electric vehicles are their range. How far can you go on a single charge? The Mini Cooper SE has the shortest range with only 110 miles per complete charge. Depending on the package you get, the Leaf ranges between 149 miles and 226 miles per full charge. The Tesla S has some of the longest ranges from 334 miles up to 520 miles. The only other company that comes close to the Tesla's range is the Lucid Air. If you want more information, I point you to Motor Trend's article where I got this information. So we have options. One major drawback is that the prices are much higher than a traditional gasoline-powered engine. But wait, you say, there's also the tax write-off you get to add in. Not quite anymore. There is a maximum $7,500 tax credit, but its use is limited. Not all electric, plug-in, or hybrid vehicles can receive the credit. The vehicle must be brand new. Used vehicles do not get the credit. You must purchase the vehicle. Rentals do not count. The base credit is $2,500, but it can increase to the maximum credit depending on kilowatt per hour capacity of the vehicle's battery. Something to think about. Automobile makers invested their time and money in developing more advanced add-on pollution control devices, like the catalytic converter, rather than developing new non-polluting systems. The pollution control mechanisms, which the auto manufacturers preferred, had pollution problems of their own. For instance, catalytic converters were extremely unreliable in early testing and could be easily rendered ineffective by leaded fuel. Converters today are vastly improved. If reliance on future technology is the primary strategy, the question remains, how do we get from here to there? Should we wait for the industry, or perhaps even an upstart like Tesla, voluntarily to develop these technologies on their own while we continue to retrofit our standard gasoline-powered cars? Or, following Title II's stark precedent, should Congress impose a draconian near-term requirement on the industry for the development and widespread use of innovative technologies? Solutions. A possible solution would be to raise the price of gas to where it should be. In Europe, gas is 3 to 4 times as expensive as it is here. Why don't we pay higher gasoline taxes in order for the revenue to be put towards research on non-combustion engines with lower pollutant levels or zero pollutant levels? And how many of you can say, see ya, to all those politicians in Washington who voted for such a measure? But wait! Gas did hit $4 a gallon in 2008, 2009, and 2010. And we are looking at those prices again due to the war in Ukraine. So raising gasoline taxes would start riots in the U.S. Take a look at the protests in France that happened over a proposed increase. If any of you are wondering about gas tax increases in the U.S., the federal government has not raised the gas tax since October 1993. For the state level, 28 states in the District of Columbia have raised gas prices since 2013. Okay, while the technology-forcing design of Title II was useful in effecting major changes in automobile pollution control, it was a painful means of doing so. Painful for the auto manufacturers in that they were forced to expend enormous sums for rapid research and development. Painful for consumers who faced sharp increases in new car costs due to the installation of pollution control devices. And painful for taxpayers, who underwrote the expensive administration of the regulations. Citizen suits. One more thing to touch on is citizen suits. Remember that if Congress doesn't give permission for a private citizen to sue, you can't get into the courtroom. Section 7604 gives Joe Public the right to sue if someone is not following the law. This can be a help to the EPA with their limited resources. But it can also be a hindrance, with environmentalists poking their nose into things that they don't understand. It is important to note the requirements and time limits here. They are very similar, if not identical, to the Clean Water Act. And you can pause this and read Section 7604. It also states that the district court shall have jurisdiction to enforce an emission standard or limitation, to order the administrator to perform such act or duty as the case may be, to apply any appropriate civil penalties, to compel agency action unreasonably delayed. In any such action for unreasonable delay, notice to the entities referred to in subsection B1A of this section shall be provided 180 days before commencing such action. So we're talking a few months there. So what does this all say in English? Any person can bring a lawsuit on his or her own behalf against a violator, the administrator, and also someone who is proposing to construct or modify a major emitting facility without a permit. This is a little different from the Clean Water Act, and U.S. district courts have jurisdiction to hear the case. Notice. No action may be commenced prior to 60 days, 2 months, guys, after the plaintiff has given notice of the violation to the administrator, to the state in which the violation occurs, to any alleged violator of the standard limitation or order, or if the administrator or state has commenced and is diligently prosecuting a civil action in according to the United States or state to require compliance with the standard limitation or order. But in any such action in the court of the United States, any person may intervene as a matter of right. And prior to 60 days after the plaintiff has given notice of such action to the administrator, except that such action may be brought immediately after such a notification in the case of an action under section respecting a violation of section 7412, All right, so notice in English. Once again, there has to be 60 days notice to the administrator, the state, and the alleged violator. But note Subsection 1B in the Clean Water Act, if the administrator of the state has commenced an action and is diligently prosecuting the action, Susie Citizen cannot file suit and can just watch from the sidelines the government's prosecution. In the Clean Air Act, Joe Public can intervene in the case as a matter of right. they can get involved. In subsection 2, you have to give the administrator notice, but if there's a violation of section 7412 or an order issued under section 7413, then you can walk into the courthouse tout suite right now. If Joe Public brings suit, the lawsuit must be filed in the courthouse nearest to the source of pollution. Let's say there is a factory in South Martin County that's got a large smokestack. Most of the emissions drop down on northern Palm Beach County. The lawsuit must be filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. Okay, which specific courthouse? There are 5 offices, with the main clerk's office being down in Miami. Look at a map and determine if the West Palm Beach or Fort Pierce office is closest to the Martin County factory. If Joe Public brings suit against a violator and doesn't include the EPA administrator as a party, the administrator can intervene or join the case as a party under the law. If the administrator is not a party, any judgment will not be binding on the United States. And whenever Joe Public files a CAA lawsuit, Susie Public or Joe Public must serve a copy of his complaint on the Attorney General of the United States and the EPA administrator so they have notice of the lawsuit. Section 7604D gives award of costs. The court, in issuing any final order in any action brought pursuant to subsection A of this section, may, it's not mandatory, award costs of litigation, including reasonable attorney and expert witness fees, to any party whenever the court determines such award is appropriate. The court may, if a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction is sought, require the filing of a bond or equivalent security in accordance with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This means if you play, you better be able to pay. The money trail. Remember, it is very expensive to bring an environmental lawsuit. You have to provide data. You have to provide expert witnesses. You have to go through all of the hoops that the law sets out, and you have to show the court that you went through each and every hoop precisely as the law says to prove that you are allowed to be in that courtroom. This costs a lot of money. Subsection D is the jackpot. If you can prove that someone violated the law and or the administrator didn't do his job, there is a possibility that your effort will make changes in the environment and you will not be in the poorhouse for it. You can get your fees paid, including attorney's fees and expert witness fees. Finally, we'll end on some CAA news over the past few years. In December 2022, EPA finalized pollution standards for large vehicles and trucks. It's the first update since 2001. In August 2019, a coalition of 22 Democratic-led states, 6 cities, and the District of Columbia filed a lawsuit against the EPA for the Trump administration's retraction of the Obama-era Clean Power Plan regulation that set specific targets for greenhouse gas reductions for each state. That's still ongoing, guys. In January 2020, the Center for Biological Diversity and Center for Environmental Health filed suit against the EPA in the United States District Court for the Northern District of California, arguing that the Trump administration delayed ensuring reductions in dangerous smog pollution from oil and gas drilling in 11 states. If you're interested in reading the original pleading in this case, there's the link. The EPA keeps a current list of all civil cases and settlements that goes back to 1998. This list contains both lawsuits filed as well as agency actions. Now, the Trump administration pulled us out of the Paris Climate Agreement. On his first day in office, President Biden issued an executive order rejoining the accords. The National Resources Defense Council issued an extensive review of the Paris Climate Agreement the day we formally rejoined, February 19th, 2021, and you can read about that there. The next class, we're going to look at the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, known as FIFRA, the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, and the Toxic Substances Control Act, known as TSCA. See you on the discussion boards.